Yet again, humanity is in the X-Men's debt.
Cyclops still won't let me fly the jet.
The last will and testament of Charles Francis.
He's here!
Apocalypse.
To me, my X-Men, welcome back, my friends. It is I, Rich Alberto, DM Philly, out here on the internet, back with you again, talking X-Men 97, Episode 8, Tolerance is Extinction, Part 1, the beginning of our three-part finale to Season 1. I, of course, am not alone. I am joined by a man who I am glad to choose as my family, the astonishing Ariel from Crying Laughing Podcasts. Ariel, how are you?
I'm so good. Listen, as Nightcrawler teaches us, blood is blood. Family is a choice.
You choose me?
And I certainly made the right choice by coming on here to talk about one of my favorite things on TV right now. I continue to love this show as it's gone on. I was so lucky with the episode that I got on here to talk about previously. And it's basically been, you know, nonstop hits since then. And I think it's, you know, I think some people feel more strongly about certain episodes than others, but like overall, I really have been having such a blast.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we keep saying week after week. Our catchphrase is, this show goes hard, Ariel. Yeah. Like, it really is not pulling any punches. It just feels like this roller coaster. It's been a real treat to have it on for 2 months. So many of these for shows sure. Come like screaming through the airwaves, and they're there, and they're gone in a flash. Fallout already happened, and it's over, and it's in our rearview mirrors, and it feels good to be lingering, hanging out with the X-Men week to week. We, of course, got together to talk about Episode 5, a catastrophic episode with a lot to unpack. Oof. But it's been a real ride since then. Mm-hmm. We've had a couple of weeks. We've had some ups and downs. We got some resolution with your girl Storm. We got some clarity. Yeah. They dragged my girl Emma out of the debris in Genosha.
Diamond in the rough.
Indeed. Baby Brown Eyes came back home. We're doing the family dynamics in the Porsche this week, Ariel. Jubilee and Roberto Da Costa dealing with like problematic parenting. Right. It's a lot to get into.
It's a lot.
I'm just curious, like, where you want to start, because it's been a fun couple of weeks.
I mean, for sure, I've been, you know, episode 5 was called Remember It, and I have off and on, mostly on every, you know, I messaged you the other day. I was like, every so often, the Rogues I Can't Feel You will just hit me out of the blue, like out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Which has been devastating each and every time. I think that certainly the show put on a performance with that episode, but also like planted a flag, right? Like they're now setting up a level of quality that they may or may not be delivering in, you know, as we get to the end of the season now, but certainly like have set the bar high for themselves. And I think that's always a little bit worrying to me, but it's also kind of exhilarating, right? Because when it's good, then it's so wonderful to see how they manage to do just that. I think it was really interesting that Storm's first episode, you know, that part one that we got mm-hmm. in episode 4 was like two kind of SpongeBob-esque distinct episodes, whereas mm-hmm. this episode 6 that came after episode 5 was like, it had just the one title, Life, Death, Part 2, but it was two episodes kind of mixed together. So mm-hmm. it was just like an interesting, different way of doing it. We got to see our boy Charles. That was crazy. I never thought we would see him this soon. I thought it was going to be more of a finale thing, which is kind of bearing out in the same way, but I didn't expect an appearance from him at all, frankly. And we also got Rogue, you know, Rogue just casually throwing Captain America's shield.
You like, gotta love
it. I think the grief certainly helped, you know, her able to catapult it further. But ultimately, as we get into this episode, episode 8, I was still a little worried, because I was like, okay, this is the now, not only are we approaching the end now, the final three, but like, as we have all known, this is the beginning of a three-part finale specifically, not just the three final episodes. So I was feeling like a little bit pressure for the show. Like, what are they going to do for me? What are they going to show me in this episode that's going to make me, like, one, have an emotional reaction? Because now that we had episode five, certainly, and some other beats across other things, like I am craving that, like, deep hit, whether it's something horrible or great. And this episode definitely delivered. Like, there was so much genuine danger. Like, when you can make the incredibly superpowered and diverse X-Men feel like they are actually legitimately in danger, I think that's a feat. And I have been thinking in the days since I first watched it and have now rewatched it, I keep returning to the main fight with the
Prime Sentinels.
Prime Sentinels. I'm like, not organic Sentinels, Prime Sentinels. And all of them being attacked at the same time. Mm-hmm. And which leads directly into probably the best part of the episode for me, the Nightcrawler and Wolverine dance fight choreography.
It's magnificent. It's magnificent. It's all violins and close-ups, baby. It is really just
and classical music.
Really, it is so good. It's such just an electric scene as the kind of centerpiece to the episode. You know, I feel you in terms of the trepidation. I mean, I had Jason Reed on last week talking through episode seven. It was a really great conversation, but it's the same sentiment that we're all feeling. I think those of us that are super invested in the X-Men, it's kind of similar to before we saw episodes one and two, and that excitement about what we might be getting, but the fear about the fact that we've, you know, been burned so many times before with these adaptations of our precious characters, especially in the world of the X-Men, right? I mean, there's like such kind of valleys amidst the peaks of the cinematic fare that we've gotten over the years with them. But when it comes down to it, when you set the bar as high as they did with episode five, it's hard not to come away from that with a little bit of trepidation of like, okay, what next? Are you going to be able to kind of like run this tightrope to the end? Can you run the gambit, Ariel? Right. So I feel you.
Mon ami, what are we going to do?
Bonsoir, mes amis.
Rogues like Pain. I'm definitely like consistently getting those hits as well. It's a little bit of like Tobias Funke crying in the shower when I think about it. She can't feel him. You know, it's very powerful. I went back for What Did I Miss and had Taylor watch these first five episodes as a brand new viewer. And she was devastated, Aaron, coming out of episode five. So in that way, I feel like, gosh, it has been a really effective season to be able to kind of capture the heart of a new viewer in that way without any of the nostalgia, as it were. But to your point, it's kind of interesting the way that we've been balancing the story, because we really are focused in on a couple of X-Men. We talked about how we've been holding Wolverine back in the wings when you were here last time. He's such a fan favorite. He dominated so many of those Fox films. And this was like his big breakout moment, really. Like, he hasn't had like kind of anything this exciting to do since he had to drive Jean to the hospital back in episode three. Right? So like, this felt pretty cool. And Bo DiMeo has been like really talking a lot on Twitter and engaging with the fans, and he was saying like, hey guys, I love Wolverine. And it was very similar to some of the thoughts that Kevin echoed with me, which is like, yeah, I'm using him differently than we may have in some of the major films, but I love him. And watching him like fall out of the sky in his Wolverine whirlwinds just shredding Sentinels to get to that Kurt beat was like a real moment for him to get to participate in, you know?
Yeah, there's so many incredible visual moments in this episode, and all of the like, it really is the choreography again of like the intimate fight that we're talking about with Nightcrawler and Wolverine, but like the Blackbird being attacked. I loved when Jean is like, Beast is gonna kill you, this is the third Blackbird in as many months.
The whole thing of Scott like, not again, we're not doing this again.
I'm not doing this again.
And Cable's like being a little bitch. Stop bossing me around.
Yeah, yeah, Mom. You know,
it's such fun so energy funny. Between them. But I think part of, I didn't get into it like deeply with Kevin, but part of what's so chilling about that too is these Prime Sentinels are coming, and they're certainly have zombie vibes. There is that element of the undead.
1,000%.
They straight up like suicide bomb that Blackbird, yeah, right? The three of them land on top and they hurl their bodies into the engine, which I think just speaks to a bit of the danger of Bastion and where it feels like chilling to bring it back to the fact of like making the X-Men feel in peril. When you can show Rogue beating the snot out of everything that gets thrown at her, and then those Prime Sentinels lay her out in one punch and kick the snot out of the rest of the team, it really does make them feel dangerous. And oh my God, Ariel, but Bastion is like the sociopathic villain that we have been waiting for in the MCU for the last 5 years, you know?
Yeah, and that was the other thing. Like, we find out about Bastion in, I believe it's the previous episode, and I was kind of like, do I care? Like,
I feel
like I have such a strong connection. Like, they're kind of threading both the needles in this very genius way, right? Because I have such a connection to Mr. Sinister, as all of us who watch the original version of the cartoon did and still do. And the idea that like Sinister is like kind of working for him, but like using him, he's like, I hate this guy, he sucks. Like, I want my pig pen full of mutants, and that's all I'm in this for, which is like so incredibly horrific, but also so sinister. And it's just like we have the sinister element to like ground us, so to speak, and then the Bastion stuff. This episode really did pull it off for me, like to learn his backstory, to learn every, you know, how he was made and, you know, his father being contaminated and all that stuff. It was like, all right, I can see this. This is like a troubled kid. Like, that's what X-Men is, right? At the end of the day, it's like a kid or like a teenager who's going through something that they don't understand. And that's what Bastion went through, right? Like, we've seen this so many times, especially with these characters. And it just feels like, oh, but this is like one case where it kind of went wrong, you know, like it went so bad so quickly and he kind of never stood a chance, right? Like, he has this, he is infected this with this thing that is not even of this time. And that's gonna, I mean, that'll send you to therapy, if not like make you into like a crazy maniacal supervillain with plans to take over the world with a technovirus. It's crazy. I mean, for it to be obviously the same, it's a perfect way to keep Cable in the loop and have that be, you know, that be their connection. It's so incredible. And speaking of Cable, when I saw that damn talking cube, my heart soared. I was loved so happy.
It's great. I love the cube. Like, we're being pulled away from all the anomalies to the Bastion stuff. I'm with you, right? He gives this whole absolutely terrifying speech about apathy. And there is a little bit of like a poke at us. I'm definitely a little apathetic about Bastion as a villain compared to Apocalypse, Sinister, some of the big kind of mainliners, even a Nimrod, who is like much more kind of prominent in front of mind to me, right? But this Theo James performance is like just extraordinary. I mean, the delivery, he's got such kind of swagger as he's dealing with all of them. Like, he calls up his little council of supervillains, and Doom does not approve Ariel, and Bastion's gonna send a memo next time. He's like talking shit to Zemo.
Next time I'll send memos, but right now we press on with the rollout.
Your Sentinel program can't go wide so long as leaders like President Kelly see the X-Men as allies.
The casualness it's so funny, right? But the casualness of which Bastion is like dealing with all of this genocide and and like this incalculable kind of evil that he is manifesting, his final dream, as his mother points it out, right? And this notion that really struck me of, we see that background of his parents, which just great attention to detail. Like, that's the waitress from back in season 4 from an episode, and like the janitor, really pulling the Easter eggs forward. But he says the X-Men thing. I want to be normal. When do I get to be normal with his mom? And part of what really struck me is that he's got seemingly a pretty loving, supportive household. Like, these are good parents who raised this very, very bad person. And this exploration of, like, bad parents raising good children that we get with, like, the Rogue and the Nightcrawler side of it, and the bad parents and good children, and then into DaCosta and his family, which is its own very charged situation. It just, the themes are so powerful, man. They're doing such a good job episode to episode, really consolidating these ideas.
Yeah, for sure. And the Theo James call out is a good one, because I remember all the speculation, you know, there was news that he had gotten cast for the voice cast for this season, and there was no, you know, indication who he would be playing, and obviously they were keeping that one pretty close to the vest.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2. We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Speaking of voice cast, Chris Potter, who is doing the voice here of Cable, who was Quiet Chang Kane's son in the TV show Kung Fu The Legend Continues, and played Gambit's voice in the original cartoon. I had known that, but I had totally forgotten all about that.
Yep.
So I love that, like, small way in which, like, Gambit's still around.
It's great.
For me, selfishly.
It's great. I know they, like, screen tested a lot of these actors. You know, I've been talking a lot about Lenore Zahn just because she's, like, talking so much about her experience coming back to the show. And they hit up a bunch of the old cast and had them do read-throughs, right? Do, like, line reads. So they recast a bunch of the old cast in different parts, right? Like, everything that we're getting with Val here, this is the old actress that played Jean, I believe.
Yeah. Catherine Disher. I'm looking at the list. It was incredible. The stuff with, I love the little, like, cameos that we got. Like, when I saw Spider-Man, I was like,
yeah, dude,
I had totally forgotten that. Like, and then I go back to, like, the 90s Spider-Man cartoon, and, like, X-Men was on that at some point. Like, there was, you know, some crossover there that was really, really fun. So, like, the idea that as this situation gets seemingly more and more dire now that Magneto has declared war seemingly by the end of the episode. Maybe not every single one of these characters that they kind of showed randomly will feature prominently, but you got to believe that some of them will, right?
Oh yeah, there's a big question. I can't wait for the Silver Surfer Silver Samurai to show up huge next episode.
And then Silver Surfer, maybe.
Yeah, and then the Silver Surfer. I'm with you. I mean, at the point that you're going to show up with Spider-Man, my hype is through the roof. I was floored. That's another one of these. DeMeo just talking about the rule of threes and the storytelling, like the three cameos at the end to give it just a little bit more sense of depth. You see it again with like the three battlefields of the Sentinels, even down to like little things. Of like your point of the choreography in that fight scene where he has like Nightcrawler bamfing in the sets of three, as it were. You really like feel the pacing. It's so exceptional because to kind of sum up what you were saying as we get started here, as we're looking towards the end of the season, you got to wonder a little bit of like, how much time do you have left? How much are you going to be able to achieve? How much are you trying to lift? And I'm feeling it in the last 2 weeks, especially where we get 20 minutes into the episode and I'm a little like, okay, there's not that much room left. And then those last 10 minutes go so hard, man. It is just unbelievable. But as we roll into Bastion and the Council of Supervillains and everything with Val and Magneto getting free, like what a stinger to set this thing up with at the end. And Kevin and I have been really focusing in on this idea, Ariel, of Magneto was right, and then the next iteration of Cyclops was
Thanos was right, question mark.
I know, right? So we've been talking about it all season, though, and the fact that it did come to such prominence and it's spoken through the words of a human, seemingly, like, I know there was some speculation Val might be Mystique, but that doesn't seem
that
like
just
it's
hit
prove
me
out.
Literally, like right before you said it, I was like, oh my god, it's Mystique.
It's been a big question for a lot of people, but like you have to wonder at this point.
Always.
It feels like we would have seen it already this episode.
Right.
Like this would have been the moment of the reveal when she sets him free. You know, there's that point where she's just like, please talk to me, scream at me, yell at me, whatever you want. And Magneto,
like you used
chilling.
To. Right.
And we do get this really unbelievable response from Magneto, Ariel, of like the freaking EMP pulse. He's shutting every pacemaker. He crashed every plane in the air. He fried out every PlayStation 1 around the planet. No, like,
I hope the planes are okay. They're probably not.
I think they're not. I think it's like part of the implication. I think that he just killed a whole lot of people, man.
A whole lot of people. Yeah. If he's like revert, like what could he do? Right. He could like technically like reverse the magnetic field. Just any way that you're fundamentally changing it, you are upsetting the ecosystem of the planet, obviously, which is he's successful at depowering the Prime Sentinels, which was obviously what he wanted. That was the whole reason he did that. But at what cost, as like Logan says at the end, he just, you know, he did it. And Morph's like, yeah, saved our asses. He's like, no, started the war. I had a question about the Prime Sentinels activation, because it seemed like the cerebral, it could have just been a coincidence, but I couldn't tell if we were supposed to think that like Hank scanning Cerebro for the Prime Sentinels was the thing that was actually activating them, or was it like more of a coincidence? Because it kind of makes sense either way.
I think that you were onto something, because we have Bastion explaining the whole Prime Sentinel thing, and he says he's got this line of like, maybe it's one night in a bar and a mutant comes and like talks to them and boom, they like activate, right?
Right.
So then we go back to Hank in the basement, which I was very much like, who let Trish Tilby down here? Why did you do this? I'm pretty sure it's Nightcrawler, and I'm like, I guess, man, I get that it's your first day. It's like that Simpsons episode of like, it's my first day. Mind Freund, I'm sorry, you know, but he brings Trish down there, and I'm a little like, I thought we dealt with this last episode. Like, Hank seemed pretty clear that he was shutting this relationship down, but I guess she's got Starbucks, so we'll like hang out for a minute, you know. But then she's encouraging him, how many more are there? And he's like, well, we'll know in a second. And he connects himself up to the machine, and I definitely read it as Trish like nudging him into doing the thing.
I can totally to
go
see
figure
that.
Out how many there are. And that idea that like his brainwave through Cerebro or whatever it is, that mutant presence is like amplified enough to activate the Sentinels. I think it could be either or, but like that was certainly my headcanon. You know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense, especially when you put the element, the Trish element there of like her kind of driving and whether that's even conscious or unconscious, or is she being controlled in some way by that, even if she doesn't quite consciously know for herself that she is also one, is fascinating and like honestly way more fascinating than just the coincidence part. I love what Logan says later. He's like, I got to talk to Hank about his taste in women or something like that.
yeah.
Stretch point. It's so funny. The what is it called? You said it before. Is it BAMFing?
The BAMF. Yeah, it's the BAMF. BAMF. There were a bunch of like little tiny Nightcrawler clones called the BAMFs that were running around the mansion for a long time. Like the BAMF is a thing. Yes.
Yeah. Right. No, I love that and the way in which like we are. For again, I just have to call it like the choreography, the him showing, you know, Logan being like, I got six reasons right here. And it's his claws. And then he's like, no, you have nine because I have a tail and I can hold a sword in that as well. It's incredible, incredibly rendered, such beautiful, beautiful animation, even though it is, like you said, so incredibly violent. But the big, big payoff was like seeing and feeling what that was like. It's not something that I think that I had ever seen, certainly not in the cartoon that I can think of.
Oh no, that was an extraordinary shot. That's like a shot of the year, man. That like in the BAMF shot, like that was electric. I've never seen anything like that.
And to feel you feel and you hear like this pulsating sound like da-doom, da-doom, da-doom as he's like traveling. It's incredible. And the way like Logan is being dragged along literally by his claws because he has his claws inside the guy, the Sentinel, really, let's dehumanize him a little bit. Is again, it's incredible. And I just thought that was when the show can make me go, holy crap, like that's not only is that something incredibly cool, but again, that's something that I haven't seen before. That's a huge win as far as I'm concerned.
I was talking to our friend back at our alma mater, Professor Wiggler, last night, and I was just like, Josh, the show goes so hard, you know, but we're talking about Nightcrawler in particular. And I said, you know, there's so much kind of inconsistent opinion about the X-Men movies, but I think that the universal take is we all really love X2. Mm-hmm. Like X2 was unbelievable.
Hell
that first opening scene of Nightcrawler in the White House, in the Oval Office.
Oh my God.
Right. That was a moment that we had never seen on film before. Mm-hmm. We all sat in theaters collectively gasping and falling in love with Kurt all over again because it was just exceptional. It was like a level up in filmmaking to see CGI do that in the same way that like watching the T-Rex chase Jeff Goldblum down was, right? It felt like that to me as a 20-year-old kid in the theaters.
Absolutely.
And this episode felt like that again. And I know it's like animation, you know, but it's like this computer assisted hand-drawn animation, but there's such attention to detail and care that goes into producing this. I mean, there's a lot of animated shows out nowadays, many of which are very, very good, you know. Invincible has like a huge fan base, but I talked to Kevin about it last night, that I saw a bunch of Invincible fans like, please could you guys do this, how do you do that on our show? This is like so next level, like it's putting kind of everything else to shame. And you know, I know that we're of a mind that it's one of the best things that's out on television right now, which is why it's just so fun week to week to dive into this. But to the Magneto of it all, I want to like get your two cents a little bit on this idea of Thal's thesis statement, Magneto was right. Like, what does that mean to you? Part of what Kevin and I unpacked is like, is there a third path? If Magneto was right, that means Charles was wrong.
Yeah.
But does that mean that we have to just get in line and follow Magneto and like do what he says? Is there a third path? I get very hype about like the root of an Emma Frost and like the inclusion of an Emma Frost and where that can kind of take us going forward. But a lot of like speculation about what we end up with at the end of the season of like, are there two teams of X-Men?
Right.
Is it Charles's and Eric's X-Men?
Right.
And I'm curious if you have thoughts there.
There, yeah, now I'm thinking of Magneto. There was some mention of his of his asteroid, and it was kind of like a Magneto reference, like, oh, we've done that before. Anyway, I just thought of that. The Magneto was right is obviously super, super fascinating, because to the Charles point, especially now as he finds himself back in the fold at the end of the episode and parroting what you say at the beginning of these pods, the idea that he, like, if Magneto was right, then Charles was wrong, but like also what he was wrong in putting Magneto in charge in his stead. But also, does that mean that he knew what would happen and he knew that Magneto would actually be best positioned if Magneto himself was right ultimately? It's like a really fascinating rabbit hole to go down. I agree with you completely that hearing it from her character's mouth, specifically the fact that she's a human, ostensibly, at least as far as we know, the fact that she's a human and the way she talks about it, right, the deja vu element of it, of like Magneto knows us better than Charles ever did. Most of us experience that just as that bit of deja vu, like, so casually being able to just kind of say, wow, that really sucked. Okay, well, I'm glad I can move on with my day, right? Because that doesn't really, really involve me. That, like, she says, we weren't surprised. Like, she's like, I wasn't really surprised that that happened, is an incredibly cutting line, especially in light of everything that we lost. So to arrive at that, like, chillingly delivered, certainly, line, Magneto was right, as we get the cross-cutting between what Magneto is now doing because he was right and him saying, mimicking what he has always said, never again, is incredible. And I love that there is so much room for that to be the debate, right? Because it's so much more fascinating when when it's Thanos, it's like very clearly a villain. When it's Magneto, it's like way more gray area there. But either way, if you can make it not just compelling, but if you can make it make sense, right? If you can at least see it from their perspective, then they've got you story-wise. And is there another way? What he was right about ultimately, which is the most fascinating thing to me, was like how humans act at their worst.
Yep.
And Charles is always leaning into how humans can be at their best. So I think that's a really, really important distinction, which I think that they have done a really good job of highlighting, because that's where Magneto lives in. That's the reality that Magneto lives in, for obvious reasons that always get repeated because of his history. And he doesn't really have that within him to believe in the good in people. And that's what Charles always rubbed off on Magneto, right? One of the many things. And the idea that now everything is going to shit, Magneto has been activated in a way that Charles is ostensibly the only person who's going to be able to walk him off that ledge, to the extent that Magneto will allow himself to be walked off of any ledge now after everything that has happened, is really, really interesting. Because now it's like, we tried it. Magneto's like, I tried it your way while you were gone and it didn't work. And not only did it not work, it really, really blew up in all our faces and we lost some really important people, especially to you, Charles. So this is really your fault. Now, what can Charles possibly say to Magneto now, right? Like, after all of this that has happened, after leaving, and now he comes back at the worst moment, obviously the best moment because we need him, but at the worst possible moment as far as what has happened, what can you even say?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot to unpack, but that fundamental distinction between them as optimist and pessimist, right? I mean, I would just think part of what's always so fascinating about their debate is that Charles has the capacity to force everybody to do what he wants, but he won't. And that's part of the kind of fundamental premise that he comes from, that he wants us to reach to be better and to choose. That's the whole point, that we have to choose to be our best selves. But Magneto knows what a world in fear is like. I don't mean to keep repeating it to anybody who's listening, but I watched The Iron Giant this week for What Did I Miss with Taylor, and it's such a Cold War movie, Ariel. The Cold War was a thing because of fear. Mm-hmm. Because when you have a population that is completely terrified universally from coast to coast, you can get them to succumb to their worst impulses and mm-hmm. follow their kind of worst judgments, to assume the worst about their neighbors, right? And I mean their neighbors in like the global sense of the word, right, and in the neighborhood sense of the word. And that's part of what we're struggling with, like, day to day, every day in the world today. So it really strikes me as powerful. Part of what Kevin really noted in just talking about this decision that Magneto makes at the end is this isn't purely retaliatory. He's not just going out there to like kill a bunch of people. He is, his goal is to save mutant lives, to stop
save as many. Yeah, we will not say that we did not save as many as we could, or whatever. Yeah, whatever his
exactly.
Line was.
Yeah. It's that Schindler moment again, right? That he has to be the one to do it. So it gives a justification behind the decision that like one could certainly understand and empathize with, if not agree with overtly. But it just leads to such a complex end that as we do have this return of Charles, a couple of episodes before, I thought he'd be back too. Uh-huh. And he makes this call to me, my X-Men. It's a very like hype moment, but like I couldn't help but note, like, I didn't see all the X-Men's faces floating around him in a pretty little circle there. Right. Like, who's going to end up where? Do you think that we end up in a position where there are like camps of perspective by the end of season one? I guess
I think it would, now that I'm thinking about it, it would almost be disappointing if not. Like, right. I have enough faith in the show certainly by now that I'm willing to take anything, you know, as long as it's earned, which for the most part they are successful at that. Mm-hmm. But I think the Scott component especially, I think, is an interesting one, because he has been really, really thrown around this season emotionally after everything that's happened to him, calling into question like his leadership and who's right. And like, I could see him, and I know there is some comic book precedent for this, but like the idea that he's like, you know what, you're both wrong. Like, I mm-hmm. like, this isn't, this like binary kind of worldview that you two seem to have, this is no longer enough for the world that we now live in, I think is interesting, because I'm not quite sure what all of this is leading to in a very interesting way within the Cyclops storyline specifically. I think Storm, for sure, she's going to be, I mean, so happy to be back, of course, but like, what is she coming back to, right? And
right.
What is she going to be like? We think that we have every reason to believe that she is so loyal to Charles, and like she wants this family to be together. But like, you know, she's also been through a lot and she's seen a lot of stuff. So ultimately,
she literally had like these enemies strip her power away, strip her humanity down, like cut her legs out from underneath her. How angry is this?
So barbaric. Does, like,
vitriol feed into her response here? I'm so curious.
Yeah, and like she's learned to wrestle with her demons in a more healthy way, certainly. It's, you know, she went through like a little mini therapy session across her couple of episodes.
Yeah.
But now, what do you choose to do with that new power, right? Like, she got her powers back, but now she has also empowered herself in a different way by kind of taking ownership of these different sides of her and her guilt and her frustration and her horrible, you know, that horrible situation that she was in and all that feelings arise from it. She's theoretically in a, you know, situation where she could be somewhat, I don't know, radicalized, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that it can just be as simple as, you know, join me, Magneto, or me, Xavier, in the same way that it always has been, because the situation does feel more complicated and nuanced now than it ever has before.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that you said something interesting before about the idea of these binary choices, right? And I think that part of what DeMeo is talking about, the notion of the rule of three and extrapolating it to a bigger level, that there may well be like a third option here. I'm trying not to like sell myself on a thing that may not happen,
right,
which is sure. The kind of inclusion of Emma Frost. Like, it felt very pointed to me that we went out of our way to be like, look, she's alive. And I know that that was also a moment to explore Scott's fear and mm-hmm. his crestfallenness that it's not Madeline, but it is Emma, who is like a very important person to Scott Summers, and I can't help but wonder what we're going to do with that going forward, whether or not like it is again this like rule of three and DeMeo is going to give us a third path driving out of season one into whatever we're going to get for a season two. I want to step in to talk a little bit about Jubilee and Roberto Da Costa, because this has been this like magnificent love affair that I did not expect, and I was like not here to ship in episode one, but I'm so on board with Ariel. Like, I love these crazy kids.
I do love them, and I feel like it's such a fundamental part of X-Men, like whatever version of the X-Men, you know, some at some point they were all teenagers, like before even Jubilee was around, and like there's always there always kind of has to be a teenager around, or like a reference to teach. Sometimes it's them, the X-Men themselves, like acting like children, but like the idea that that this is where they all started, I think, is fundamental to the X-Men. And also to me personally, I love Jubilee. Like, not everyone's a fan. I know, like, in the past, she's, you know, people have thought she was annoying or ineffectual or whatever. But, like, I enjoy the Jubilee time, okay? I enjoyed the Jubilee half episode. I thought it was fun, like, to see her interact with, like, another version of herself. I'm a sucker for that stuff anyway. And here, she's... exploring like her newfound sense of independence and freedom, and she's getting the outfit update, and like now she has like the all black, which is very classic, and I love when she's like, you know what, don't even tell me, I love it, so I'm gonna get that. I don't even care what you think about my outfit.
While you give her time, you're giving me this new outfit. Thoughts? Actually, save them. Love it.
To the Roberto part of it, it is really sad, and this is once again very, very X-Men, of like the dealing with the parents, something that you touched on earlier, and this is like kind of the opposite of that other thing, right, of like the good or the good kid with the bad parent, or with the parent that you think is going to be good and do the right thing, but ultimately they kind of swerve and say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing out of ignorance, out of peer pressure. Like, he basically comes out to her in that moment, so to speak, you know, to extend that metaphor for a little bit. And she ultimately chooses, you know, maybe you should go with these like perfectly safe looking Prime Sentinel policemen. Like, that's kind of how that went down. And then they just kind of walk away. Like, the one thing I did get mad about Jubilee, I was like, no, fight, get out of there. Screw that. Leave him if you have to. But they're in it together. And it was really fun to see her, and like the way, part of what I love so much about the Prime Sentinel attack, like I said before, was like that they were all being attacked across different storylines at the same time, and how much more dangerous that situation feels because they are all so separated.
Yep.
And her especially, we know she's not the most powerful mutant, certainly not in her current form, and you feel that danger so keenly. Like, if Jubilee's in danger, I feel like I'm in danger. And I was so glad that Sunspot is there to help her. But I have to say, she held her own for a while there.
I know that she's not everybody's favorite. She's not at like the top of any of my lists. I always make fun of, there was about 10 years in the comics where she was like a vampire, and that was not great. I didn't love Vampire Jubilee. Like, not a great look. But this is some of the best Jubilee stuff to me. Like, her I Can't Fly, like with the fireworks jumping off the roof, is just like amazing. And there's also been like some speculation in the comics that like she does these little fireworks, but she's like potentially destroying like molecules on a subatomic level that could like blow up the whole solar system if she figured it out. So I don't know if that's true or not. I think that she doesn't know if it's true or not, but I think that is part of what always makes her fun, is that she's not that like intense about this stuff sometimes, right? Like, that's the least important thing to her, how powerful her abilities are. Uh-huh. She wants to like live her life and go to the mall. Black cat suit feels very like late 90s. We're rolling into like Matrix era. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? Some real like shades of Trinity under the yellow raincoat there, Ariel. And I just like the two of them a lot. You know, the metaphors have always been there. We went back, like I said, I went to the Movie Ladder podcast earlier this week with Kevin, and we talked about that original Fox X-Men film. And it's just such an overt, like kind of queer-coded metaphor, man. And it is in the subtext, right? It is not addressed in any kind of like forward way, not even as like explicitly as it is in X2. So to really like see it presented in this episode so kind of powerfully. And it's a complicated issue. It's something Kevin and I talked a lot about in our coverage of this week, how you deal with a family member like this, where you draw your lines on, back to this whole notion that Kurt's going to give us of like blood is blood, but family is a choice. You know, there comes a point where you can close the doors and like exercise people from your life. But like, can you, will you, are you willing to do that? Where is the line? Like, where do you take a stand? When do you fight? And then that other notion, which again just feels so in conversation with what Bastion is very cleverly weaponizing against the populace, which is our apathy, right? Mm-hmm. And this notion that his parents are so willing to abdicate their responsibility for anything as soon as somebody vaguely authoritative steps in the room, right? Like I talked with Kevin about, like, you know, that techno-organic virus, the sentinel tech, it like basically is a cop uniform, right? That they come knocking on the door. It's like, yeah, okay, take my child away, whatever it is. And it's such an indictment on where we're at and the ways that we've allowed apathy to encroach upon our morality. Like, we know that's part of what's so important about what Val says. We know better, but we have to like get up and go deal with our bullshit tomorrow. So we're just going to silo off that whole issue of genocide or the whole issue of inclusion or the whole issue of civil rights, because what can I do, right? And it's powerful, man. It's just such powerful messaging, you know.
No, for sure. And again, like that's some of what X-Men has always kind of done, playing in that sandbox of those metaphors. And it always hits. And then you're always wondering, like, which kind of parent is this person going to be, right? Because you've seen the different kinds. You're like, please, please, please be the good kind. Please be the good kind. And then you just see it kind of wash over her face. You're like, no, this is devastating. It never gets any easier. Because to your point, we all, you know, we understand that to varying degrees of like whether it matches our experience or not, of like having to draw boundaries in families and from people and even in like our personal relationships, and how difficult that can be and how painful that is when like a person shows you a side of them that seems to or does outright reject some part of you, whether, you know, some honest truth that you are sharing. And it's horrible, because then you're like, that leaves you in a place, especially when you're a teenager, where you're just kind of unsure about what is quote unquote right, because you're questioning if you're even right and like what's wrong with you and all that, all that stuff. But I can say for sure, definitely not as bad of a mother as Bastion's mom turns out to be, only because, and it's not really her fault, she turns out to be a sentinel herself, and that's pretty messed up of Bastion to do that.
It's very dark, especially because it seemed like when he was a little kid and very troubled, she was pretty supportive and kind to him. Like, I love you, little Bastion. You're just my son. Some explicit one-for-one shots of the Bastion growing up montage to Zack Snyder's Man of Steel. I don't know if you saw any of that, but DeMeo said that he's got some affection. It's a little bit of an homage there. He even joked that, like, oh yeah, Bastion's mom, her name is Martha.
His name is Martha.
Like, really killed me. That's a good one. That's it got me pretty good. But I mean, I thought that it's a really powerful setup to get Bastion, you know, like it was a very kind of fast track origin story, but I kind of like it because it's actually like paying back to those episodes from the original series, that if you go back and rewatch the destruction of Master Mold and the attack of Nimrod, and all the pieces are there already. So even though it like feels fast and this episode, it feels like the work was done. But I just come out of this week, Ariel, like, oh my god, Bastion is terrifying. I feel really good about the possibility of this as a villain. I never would have expected a month and a half ago that I would care about Bastion of all of like the X-Men kind of rogues gallery, but it seems like he may emerge out of this as a really dangerous individual. I'm really excited to see how, where Storm like crashes back into the group.
Yes, Omega level threat, where are you? I wanted her to fly in and help. I thought she was gonna appear any second this episode.
Me too. We really held her in the wings. I was kind of feeling it in the fight at the mansion of like protect Rogue. I thought like she might show up, but also like I'm glad she let the boys have their moment. They needed it. It was excellent.
No, it was incredible. And just to call it another awesome moment when Cyclops and Jean and Cable Nathan are in the car, and he's just, they're doing like live dynamite blasting through the mountain, but it's via optic blast specifically, was really incredible. Like, it reminded me of like the first episode where Cyclops is using his optic blast to kind of skate around the room and propel mm-hmm. himself in different directions, which was awesome. And, you know, nice to see a family working together, even as Jean doesn't really know if her memories are hers.
Again, a Nightcrawler with the truth bombs of like, does it matter? Memory, memory is just a dim echo of emotion. He's so good.
When I'm looking at those yellow eyes, I think they're yellow, right? I'm just like, man, you got so much going on. It's so beautiful.
It's so great. My favorite moment of the episode was definitely that Doom does not approve of war crimes. Like, Doom, like, being there really, like, sent me. But my second favorite moment of the episode is definitely the little bitty smile that Scott gives to Cable. Like, you've got a Porsche? And there's just this tiny shot of Scott like, oh, yeah.
So sweet. Yeah, oh, I love that Cable knows about Porsche. I wonder if he learned that from his floating computer cube.
Ariel, this is why I know you think about time travel as much as I do, because this is exactly the question I had of like, where did you learn Porsche, Cable?
Are they still where along Porsche? The time stream? Also, speaking of time travel, when we're getting that like devastating but incredible explanation about like, we have tried to, he tried, you know, it fills in the blank of what was happening when we saw him in Genosha in that episode 5 of like, he keeps getting pulled from that event. He tried so many times. I'm like, oh, wow, this is some real dark energy here. And I mean the Netflix show Dark that you and I love so much of like trying the same thing over and over again. It's devastating. And I'm such a sucker for any of that time travel stuff. The idea that he has lived, who knows how many times, right? He doesn't even put a number on it, but he has, through his travels, he has lived like so much time in these between moments that he's, you know, in a way older than he actually is like endlessly fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's delightful. The whole like little thing of Jean realizing that's why Madeline was happy when she died. She doesn't even like finish that final word. The recognition of him being with this mother. Huge Doctor Strange connections there, right? As Beast is going to call out Kamar-Taj. Yes. We see the timeline in Cable's hologram is very Loki, sacred timeline. Yes. There's even
next event.
Yeah, the whole idea also that we talked about after episode 5 of like, well, they'll bring Gambit back. Cable, like, he's here. Apocalypse, time travel shenanigans, baby. But this being a fixed event and that he has gone so many times, much like Strange and the millions of possibilities. But this is it. Like, Genosha happened. Whatever happened, happened. We can't fix it. We can't repair it. We can't undo it. And seemingly our boy Remy LeBeau is gone. So that's a real, like, kind of heavy pill to swallow coming out of it too.
I can't feel you. I don't know what to do. And you know, and we've already talked about this, but the idea that like they could undo it and should they, and you know, speaking of Jurassic Park, just because they could do something, should they do something? Because you know, we love that pain so much of the death because it hurts so good because it was so well earned. And then for them to undo it, it's like that's a big risk to take with, you know, all the good that they have done with this show and how much we've all loved it. So again, I trust them, but I'm worried. You know, I don't like to mess around with time travel just willy-nilly for my own personal.
No, it's a very serious business. Yes. When we're approaching time travel, we have to approach it with the utmost seriousness, Ariel.
Always.
It was a real excellent episode. I mean, it leaves us in a very fascinating place as we drive out for the end of it. Is there anything else that we didn't get to that you want to drop down on?
All I want to say is it's such an incredible, like, comedic moment for me when the mansion is just, like, on fire, in shambles. They've had this, like, incredible fight. And then Logan's like, oh, where's the professor when you need him? And then he, like, crash lands into the already burning mansion that is just like so extra. Like, it's the idea that it's kind of his fault and also he's coming too late and now he's actually doing more damage to the mansion.
Yeah,
was so funny.
I am so glad you clocked that. I'm like, this guy is literally about to marry the queen of an intergalactic empire, and this is their landing system, is to come hurtling into the building. They were able to aim it very effectively, right. Ariel.
He's like, I want to land on the front line. They're like, I got you. Got this. And they're like, oh no, oops.
They were able to hit the mansion from a distant galaxy, but they did not put any
brakes
in there.
They put the dot on Google Maps in the wrong place.
And then he comes out with that bug helmet, too. Yeah.
I was like, oh, no, not Phoenix Saga all over again.
It's so ridiculous, man. There's part of the show, like, that's where it is, just so next level. Because we're dealing with, like, these heavy social issues with, like, genocide and intolerance and social justice and all of it. It really is, like, packed full of very fraught emotions and powerful themes. But also, like, it's so ridiculous and extra. Mm-hmm. You know, we got, like, cyberpunk Dracula as Taylor dubbed Sinister over here, like, whirling and twirling, you know, Doom does not approve. So Magneto, much of it is very over the top.
Magneto's in the Arctic in his underwear, right?
Yeah, he's full, like, thirst trapping in the cold, right, you know?
Like, Magneto, like, oh my God.
It's really next level, man. Extraordinary bit of television. Ariel, thank you for swinging back around to talk through episode 8 with me. I always have such a joy talking to you about anything that we both love. It is a very good time. You're keeping busy out there on the lean, mean internet streets. What do you got going on?
This was so much fun. Operation Zero Tolerance as far as bad stories. We only like good stories, and this is for sure one of the greats. Like, once Shogun finished, I was like, damn, now all I have is X-Men. And so grateful for it, of course. I am, talking about a whole bunch of stuff over on the Crying Laughing podcast, which I co-host with Dr. Amanda. We've had, you know, we're still chugging along with our 6 Feet Under rewatch recaps, but also dabbling in some really fun bonus pods. We covered Shogun season 1, speaking of, last week, and also covered Challenger's movie. We had Grace Leader on. That was super fun. And there's another bonus pod coming up next week with another special guest. I'm super excited about that. You can follow me on Twitter at That Other Ariel. Follow the pod for more episode info at Cry Laugh Pod. This has been the best. I'm so happy that we still have 2 more episodes, and I'm trying not to think about that we only have 2 more episodes, if you know what I mean.
I know. At least we know that season 2 is, like, locked and loaded. The creative team that did season 1 is contributed to season 2. So I'm excited to see where it goes. But
yeah.
I'm at DM Philly in all the places. You can go follow me. You can find me on Twitter at Screen Page Pod or all of our social medias. There's a link tree there that's got all the links to get you into our Discord or to the various podcast feed. Ratings and reviews are always appreciated. Myths and Legends, our Wheel of Time book club is going strong. We're up to the third part. We're reading through chapter 42 of book 1 of Robert Jordan's epic fantasy series, The Wheel of Time. We are getting ready to fire up some coverage of Outer Range season 2. I covered season 1 with the commensurate Austin Smith back at Post Show Recaps. You're going to see a bunch of the Outer Range season 1 podcast populate the Screen and Page feed over the weekend. May 12th is the premiere of season 2. Josh Brolin. It is a bit of a dark Yellowstone type of show. So if you like either of those things,
listen,
I think there's some juice there for you. And
that's all you had to say. Josh Brolin, I'm already from the outside like, maybe I should watch this.
Scope it out, Ariel. I'd love to have you in to chat about it if you do. It's a pretty good show. I really liked season 1. It was a bit of a sleeper that not a lot of people put eyes on, but I thought it was quite, quite good. Taylor and I, what did I miss? We're going back through the media that made us. We talked the Iron Giant this week, and I gave her a hard 180-degree turn. We're going from Iron Giant to Heavy Metal, probably the most offensive of the films that we are going back for in What Did I Miss? So we'll see what her takes are about that. But we will be back next week talking about Episode 9 of X-Men 97. Until then, just remember, Magneto was right.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.